damages fall against the Insurance Company of North America. Mr. Forrester.
Yes, sir. The court ready to proceed? May it please the court. My name is Gary Forrester. I appear for the plaintiff appellant in this matter, Tori Hall. This case is concerned with the scope of coverage of an employer's disability policy, and it's undisputed that the plaintiff was entitled to 60% of her pre-disability income, but the question is whether the employer's insurer may reduce its payment of that 60% based upon the benefits that the plaintiff received from a separate, private, non-ERISA, optional policy. That's the question before this court, before the district court. Now, the district court, in plaintiff's submission, erred in two respects. Two general respects, two broad headings. One was with respect to the interpretation of this ambiguity in the LENA policy. Was it ambiguous? Was it not? And secondly,
is there any ambiguity in the phrase group insurance or franchise insurance? One would think that these are terms known in the insurance literature. If you go to the treatises, the insurance treatises or the cases, what do you find as definitions of those terms?
Your Honor, what I looked at, and the interesting that came about by way of the defendant's brief, there's a case called McNeely, decided by this court in 1993, cited in defendant's brief. In McNeely, this court looked at two statutes to determine whether the word employment was ambiguous or not.
I'm asking a focused question about
group.
What the term group insurance or franchise insurance is understood to mean in insurance cases, in treatises, and so on.
To answer your question directly, I find very little in the case law about group plan, group policy, group insurance.
Tell you what Crouch on Insurance says. It says it's a very well-known, clearly defined term, and it includes associational coverage under a master policy.
Yes.
Now, your client appears to have obtained this insurance as a member of an association. Was there a master policy?
There was a New York Life policy, Your Honor, and she got into that membership by way of her qualification as certified public.
The question I'm asking is, was her insurance under that master policy, or did she then have an individual one-on-one negotiated policy?
It was under that master policy.
It was under a master policy.
Yes, sir.
Well, that sounds like it fits within the normal definition in Crouch, although Crouch also suggested that it may matter whether the association retains some responsibility for payment, that is, whether the group is viewed as the insured. What do we know about whether the accountants group retained any responsibility for payment?
In this case, the record's very sparse, but to the extent it does address this, by way of the plaintiff's pro se motions for reconsideration and 60B motions, she paid the premiums solely on an optional basis.
That's a different question from the question whether the association retains secondary responsibility.
All I can say, Your Honor, is the record is silent. I would be just telling you off the top of my head with it.
That may be a little difficult because, of course, your client has the burden of persuasion at this stage.
But our burden, as I see it, Your Honor, with respect, is to convince this court that there is ambiguity in the ERISA policy. And if you look specifically at the Medicare
legislation, it would be easier to persuade me that there was ambiguity if, for example, you look in another treatise and they disagree with Crouch, or you look at a state court decision and it says, no, that's not what group insurance means in our jurisdiction.
If there's really some
underlying understanding in this industry of what group insurance is, and the fact that laymen may not get it until they read Crouch wouldn't mean it's ambiguous. It would just mean they hadn't read Crouch yet.
If I can take Your Honor through the McNeely analysis, because I think it answers your question directly. If you looked at the Medicare statute or the Internal Revenue Code, they speak of group health plans, for example. Now, group health plans are expressly distinct from employer plans. In those, if you have an employer plan, that's not, or that, that if you have an employer plan, that is what a group health plan has to be. If it's not an employer plan, it's not a group health plan. In other words, if we were looking at that legislation, you would find some ambiguity, because a group health plan has to be limited to an employer situation. That's basically what we're arguing here, is that we have a plan that's not an employer plan, the New York plan. The LENA plan is an employer plan. In the absence of definitions in the LENA plan, which is the ERISA plan, telling us what a group health plan is there any ambiguity? If you look at the statutory definitions of group health plan, you find a definition of group health plan that's different from that proposed by the defendant in this case. And the reason I mention McNeely is that's exactly the analysis this court took in McNeely. It was trying to determine whether the word employment was ambiguous or not. Employment's another word that most people would have a pretty clear idea of what they mean by employment, but the question was whether a landlord was an employer within the meaning of the legislation, within the meaning of the Act. The court looked at the Internal Revenue Code and at the Social Security Act and found that a landlord is not an employee within the meaning of those acts. And here's what the court said. Although these interpretations are, of course, not binding here, because there was no Social Security issue, there was no Internal Revenue Code issue, although they weren't binding, the fact that McNeely's gutter cleaning would not be considered employment in either of those contexts established at a minimum that the term does not unambiguously encompass such activity. That's exactly what we're saying here. At a minimum, there is an ambiguity in terms of what is a group health plan, what is group care. It's not defined in the policy.
This contract doesn't speak of group health plans. The language in the contract is, quote, any group or franchise insurance or similar plan for persons in a group. Right? So what we need to know is whether group insurance is ambiguous as used in the insurance industry, not whether, quote, group health plan is ambiguous or not. That's why I've been asking what we know about what either the state courts or the treatise writers have given as definitions of the term group insurance.
Well, Your Honor's given one. I'm unaware of any other in the industry that that resolves what is a group plan.
But that's, I hope you see my problem. If we've got a treatise definition that says this is a known term and here's what its meaning is, unless there's some source of disagreement, it's hard to see how it would be viewed as ambiguous. It would just be a term of art known in the industry.
But with respect, Your Honor, that's not the test. It's not whether a treatise defines the plan or not. It's the test for ambiguity is whether a reasonably intelligent person would know what a group plan was or what group insurance was or what a group disability insurance plan was. Accepting that the plaintiff is a reasonably intelligent person, would she have understood that? Number one, there are no definitions in the plan. Number two, if you look to other statutes, you would find definitions that were contrary to that advocated by the defendant. And applying that test, rather than the test of whether a learned treatise provided a definition, you would come up with an ambiguity, as the court did, as this court did in the McNeely case, using exactly the same approach. So my submission is that although the Social Security Act and the Medicare Act and the Internal Revenue Code are not binding on this court, they do suggest to this court that at a minimum, as McNeely held, there is an ambiguity in this expression, group plan, franchise plan, group disability insurance, etc. Secondly, the district court erred in its process in many ways. It applied New Mexico law to an ERISA policy, and New Mexico law cannot be applied to an ERISA policy. Only federal law can be applied in interpreting an ERISA policy. The district court allowed the parties to stipulate that New Mexico law and federal law were identical. The district court cannot allow that to happen. It has to make its own determination based upon federal law as to the meaning of an ERISA policy. The district court failed to go through a choice of law analysis in defining the New York policy. The New York policy was a policy made in Texas. Arguably, Texas was the applicable law in determining what it meant, but the district court did nothing in terms of a choice of law analysis. the district court sought no evidence with respect to these very problems we're discussing. There was no evidence about what the meaning of a group plan or group policy was. There could have been evidence taken from the plaintiff, evidence taken from experts in the field to enlighten the court, but none of that was done. We had a summary judgment in the absence of any of that kind of evidence. The court itself failed to define group plan or group insurance in its decision. It just made the assumption, without any authority, that the New York plan was a group plan. And finally, as indicated, the court failed to dispose of plaintiff's pro se motions under Rule 59 and Rule 60. I see that my time is up, Your Honors. For the reasons stated, I ask that the matter be reversed and remanded to the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Forrester. Mr. DiPoli.
Good morning, Justices. If it pleases the court. My name is Steve Debley, and I represent Life Insurance Company of North America. The issue in this case is very straightforward. The policy provides we will pay benefits 60% of your salary. It's an employee benefit purchased by your employer. The obvious intent is to provide some minimal protection to their employees. The policy, in an attempt to control costs, obviously excludes other payments. And they are listed and they are identified. Social Security benefits, Canada and Quebec pension plans, and any group or franchise insurance or similar plan for a person in a group. That is an easily understandable term.
So you can get an individual policy and override or supplement without having it accredited against the plan.
Yeah, there is no provision for any deduction for an individual disability policy. Had she purchased such a policy, there would be no deduction. But clearly, there is a deduction or a reduction in benefits for a group policy. A group policy is a policy issued to a group. I mean, you don't even have to go to the treatises. I buy a policy.
I must say, counsel, that believing that you don't, you just know the meaning of insurance policies based on what laymen think, and that you shouldn't bother reading cases and treatises and stuff like that, is not a position we often hear from insurance companies.
Right.
Right? What we're usually told is that these are complex terms of art. We've been working on them for 100 years. The reason we use this term is because, you know, the House of Lords defined it that way in 1635, and we've been using it ever since. Why should an insurance company now be telling us, oh, turn off your higher mental processes, forget you ever went to law school, empty your head of all knowledge, and, right? It's a very strange argument for an insurance company.
I did not mean to imply that. What I meant was that a group policy is a term that is clear, unambiguous.
No, it's not clear and unambiguous. It is a term that has, as I've learned from doing a little research, a history to it.
It does.
I'm surprised, however, that you didn't bother to tell us that history in your brief.
It is clear from reading the term what it means.
Oh, it's clear.
And it is clear, I believe, when you look at the New York policy and it identifies itself as a group policy.
All right. Let me give you, if I'm not supposed to look at treatises or anything like
that. I didn't
that,
say we weren't.
Let me give you another reading of group policy, which strikes me as a layman, a perfectly appropriate reading. There's a policy in which, in order to control the risk of opting out and adverse selection, everybody is in or out. Employers offer group policies in the sense that they cover everybody in a classification of work. You can't opt out. That controls the chance that people who are safer than the norm will opt out, and it makes sure the insurer gets in the pool the average actuarial characteristics of the pool.
Correct.
And on that understanding, a group policy is one over which there is no individual choice. The decision is made at the group level rather than at the individual level. And insurers often have good reasons for doing that. But if that's what a group policy means, this policy isn't that, because this is an individual decision by the plaintiff to opt in or opt out. And on that understanding, maybe a perfectly sensible economic understanding, this is not a group policy.
This is a policy offered to a group of people. It is a policy issued
but look,
to an association.
That's the problem. Is it a policy offered to a group, or is it a policy that covers a whole group in or out at once? There's no definitional clause in your policy that will choose between these two things. Now, maybe there are things in the cases, or the history, or the background, or the treatises that will choose between them. But staring at them and holding your breath till you go blue won't help you choose between them. This is not a plain language problem.
I believe it is a plain language problem. I mean, as I read group policy, it's a policy that is issued to a group rather than to an individual. Whether it's a voluntary group that participates or whether it is a mandatory group, a group policy is a group policy is a group policy. This is a group policy.
If that's the position you want us to take, counsel, you lose. This policy is insolubly ambiguous. It doesn't choose between those two options. That's why I'm so surprised at your line of argument. The line that says, just stare at the words, the meaning will come to you, is a line on which this policy is ambiguous.
Can we look at the other policy and see how it identifies itself? And it identifies itself as a group policy. A group disability policy certificate was issued to Ms. Hall. It's part of the record in this case.
Now, as the policyholder, and that first it's entitled Group Insurance Certificate, and the policyholder is a trustee of Texas Society of Certified Public Accountants Insurance Trust.
Correct.
And the administrator is Sedgwick
James
Group Service Incorporated.
Yes. Now, the LINA policy, Life Insurance Company of North America policy, does not require that this be a group policy that you don't, that's paid for by somebody else. It doesn't require that it be an ERISA group policy. It doesn't require that it be a policy where your employer participates. It merely requires that if there is other group policy coverage, that there is a reduction. And a group policy is a policy issued to a group or an association. The New York Life policy is a policy issued to a group or association that she received benefits under.
In that other group policy, I'm not sure it's totally significant, but does that require a medical exam and everything to get into that, or just by being in the group you're eligible for that insurance?
I honestly don't know. I would suspect that it would require no health exam. That's typical.
Which would be the case of an employer.
Which would be the same as an employer.
Judge Eichberg says that everybody's in, therefore that's how you come up with the the base table.
But in this case, I honestly do not know if it was required. And we had nothing to do with the New York policy, obviously. In reviewing this case, plaintiffs originally took a position that the term group was vague and ambiguous. When the case was presented on cross motions for summary judgment, they took a position that the other insurance clause had to be read with the other benefits clause, and that the other insurance clause caused the other benefits clause to become vague and ambiguous. Now they've returned to a position that the term group is vague and ambiguous. I don't believe that it is. I don't believe that this reference to employer has anything to do with this case. Employer is a confusing term that has different meanings in the Industrial Commission than it does in an agency case, than it may in an IRS case. It is not a clear and unambiguous term such as group policy. Their reference to a letter from New York Life in their reply brief is somewhat confusing in that it refers to a medical policy. It does not even refer to a policy in connection with this policy. The policy numbers are different. This is a health insurance claim. It has nothing to do with the applicability. I believe that the LINA policy is clear and unambiguous as to entitlement to deduction, and the proper deduction was taken. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Forrester. The case is taken under advisement.